tonight on Arena. We talk to rock and roll's first female roadie, Tana Douglas, and we go in search of Bint Coppers in Line of Duty. You can text the programme on 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena. To film reviews first tonight, and we have quite a mix of fiction, documentary and autobiography. In the awkwardly titled Preparations to Be Together for an Unknown Period of Time, director Lily Horvat gives us an unusual love story set in Hungary. We look at a documentary on Banksy, The Most Wanted, which attempts to put shape on the mysterious career of the graffiti artist who still manages to keep his or her identity under wraps while also keeping the art world enthralled. And we have My Father and Me, Nick Broomfield's consideration of his father's photographic work and their lives together and apart. Tara Brady and Darrell Jones join me now, and we'll go to Preparations to Be Together for an Unknown Period of Time, which won the Best Director Award this year at Dublin's International Film Festival for the director. Darrell, Martha is a 40-year-old neurosurgeon who is returning to Hungary from the US for what we think is a short stay. Set the scene for us, please.
Yeah, so she's a very brilliant neurosurgeon at the top of her profession, working in New Jersey, and at a conference she meets and has a connection with, perhaps falls in love with, a Hungarian man called Janos, and they agree to meet in Budapest on the Liberty Bridge on a given day some weeks in the future. So she flies home to Budapest, but when she gets there and she's in the rendezvous place, Janos doesn't show. But she tracks him down to the hospital where he works. And when she encounters him, he blanks her, effectively denies that he's ever met her. So she's on her way home, and in the airport, she has a moment of crisis, turns back, decides that she will stay in Budapest, gets a job in the same hospital. She's way overqualified for it, she's told, but she gets a job in the same hospital and moves into, deliberately chooses to move into a grotty apartment because it overlooks the bridge where she was to have the rendezvous. So I think the question that she's asking and the question that we are asking as viewers is, what's going on here?
Yes, Tara, that's what we're wondering. She's been rejected by this man, mm-hmm. but then she makes this huge life-changing decision on a pivot in the airport, turns around, comes back, and then seems to embrace this life in a hospital, which must seem so rudimentary to her, given that she works in the United States.
Yeah, it's a very, very intriguing premise, and the film flirts with all sorts of possibilities. The cinematography plays a lot with like little shadows and sort of things happening in the frame. So there's always that possibility that there's something supernatural going on. But given her expertise, her area of expertise, you have this idea all the time that, you know, there's that maybe this is something that's happened in the brain. Maybe this is some kind of quirk in the brain. Or maybe love itself. There's kind of larger analogy here, like it's something diseased that happens in the brain. And I think the film takes that premise and it like plays it out like really brilliantly. There's an intimate scene that you're not entirely sure if it's a fantasy or if it's happened in your head or if it's happened in real life. There's a wonderful scene, courtship scene, where they're walking home on this very strange zigzag pattern on the pavements, and it's almost like watching a David Attenborough documentary, and there's two exotic birds sort of hopping around each other, and again you're not entirely sure if this is happening in her head or in reality. So the film really, really does a very, very good job at juggling those things and keeping you guessing. And there's also this, I think, possibility that the film raises is that maybe this is the romantic notions of a returning migrant. Like, maybe this is like that. This is something that she has projected into the world because she wanted to come home on some level.
Okay.
So there's always that possibility as well.
Well, we're going to ask Daryl the very hard neurosurgery question in a moment, but we'll listen to a clip first. This is Martha, played by Natasha Stork, and she watches a video clip of herself explaining how she performs awake surgery on a brain tumour, and this is in English.
Doing awake surgery gives the surgeon and the patient a safety margin so that we can continue to remove the tumor while confirming the patient is well and capable of having normal conversation. Before we even do the awake mapping, we have what I call a low resolution of the brain map. We're doing functional MRI before surgery. We also use surgical navigation, which is almost like a GPS, I tell my patients. That tells us at all times where we are in the brain. Combining these two, we come to the operating room with a strategy as to how to address the tumour.
So that's Natasha Stork there as Martha in the film. Daryl, this is, so she's a neurosurgeon. We hear a lot about neurosurgery, about the choices neurosurgeons make during these intricate operations. And as we've heard already from Tara, there's something otherworldly about this film. So what is the neurosurgery scenes and this scene, and then there's a later, a very long operation scene. What is going on there? Is this symbolic, or is it just showing us what she does as her profession?
Well, it's both, but I think, you know, I think this is a film whose logic, insofar as it has one, is symbolic. It's a film full of symbols, full of images, and the brain and its mysteries is the major, I think, symbol in the film. So she is a neurosurgeon. Janos, the man she has pursued to Budapest, has just written a book on the mysteries of the human brain, and he likens it to a city with various neighbourhoods. So in the same way that we've just heard Marta talk about a GPS map to the brain. So what Tara was saying a moment ago about there being a very intimate connection, I think, here between, you know, the returning migrant returning to her own city, which is a mystery to herself now, which is strange and alien to herself, and the workings of her own mind being alien to herself. And there are all kinds of, you know, there is, as you say, a long scene of brain surgery where she deliberately stops operating when it turns out, when she thinks that she might damage her patient's language function, even though she's told most other surgeons would simply have gone on. And Janos says that, you know, if the brain is a city, sometimes you have to destroy ugly buildings, ugly parts of the brain to save a palace, to save the whole. And so these are the kinds of questions that the film deals with, and the kinds of logic that the film plays with.
Yes, and that uncertainty, Tara, is it frustrating, or does it lend to a deeper, more interesting film overall?
Oh, I definitely think it lends to a more interesting film. I mean, I found it wonderful. I mean, I found it wonderful just playing and teasing out the endless possibilities of the film in my mind.
Yes.
I think it's related to a certain type of, there are some films that are like, an obvious example, the most famous example, I suppose, being the Charlie Kaufman scripted Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. There's also Alain René, Je t'aime, je t'aime. And there's also a little bit of An Affair to Remember, but this is very much its own thing. It has its own textures, and as Daryl's saying, like, you know, it has sort of layers. There are so many things that are in the film that work both literally and figuratively. I'm always up for that. And it's also worth mentioning Natasha Stork's central performance, which is really wonderful, and like the rest of the film, like, really keeps you guessing, because she's completely obsessed, and she behaves like an obsessive, but she's nothing like your stereotypical movie bunny boiler, because generally those women don't tend to be neurosurgeons for one thing,
but
she's very kind of cool about
yes,
it very yeah. calculating
Stars out of five, Tara.
Oh, I'm five.
And five. And for you, Daryl?
I like this film a lot as well, so five.
Five out of five for preparations to be together for an unknown period of time. Next, we have the documentary Banksy Most Wanted, which delves into the work of the unknown identity of Banksy, the graffiti artist whose work has transfixed the art world and whose canvases are on the walls and doorways of the world. And they really ask the fundamental question, you know, do we know who he is, and is it important to know who he is? Tara, in this day and age, it's hard to stay anonymous. How does this documentary show how Banksy does it?
Well, they do make the point, and it's an interesting point, and it's one that's been made before. That Banksy claims that, well, certainly his the people around him or people who know him claim that he's never actually worked at night, that he's not doing his work under cover of darkness, that he does it in broad daylight. So I suppose a good analogy would be Edgar Allan Poe's detective story, The Purloined Letter, where, you know, there's a famous detective is called in to solve the mystery of this missing letter, and it's left just sitting there in the letter rack, and no one thinks to look for it there because it's too obvious. So that is what we believe Banksy does, that he's like kind of, he just sort of brazens it out. But it is extraordinary. It's an extraordinary thing. And at one point, Craig Williams, who's one of the journalists who interviewed in the film, who has come up with a famous Banksy theory, or a theory at least that was famous and was reported all over the world for about 5 minutes. His own theory connected Banksy to Massive Attack. But he says something that just struck me, and he says, oh, he talks about, I thought I'd go after the biggest story in the world, not like who killed JFK, but something everybody can connect to, something everybody is interested in, who is Banksy. And I thought about that for a moment, and it's like, it really has superseded questions like who killed JFK or who is the Zodiac killer. But I think at the same time, there's also a degree of people wanting to hear theories but not really wanting to know, because it doesn't really matter and it might actually destroy the mystery. And I think in the day and age that we live in, when there are cameras on every major thoroughfare, it's a little miracle that he's still as anonymous as he is.
Okay, let's listen to Craig Williams. As you said, he's a journalist. He was a student journalist and a blogger in 2016 when he believed he discovered that Banksy was in fact Robert Del Naja from the Bristol group Massive Attack. Now, there's strong language in this.
I also never realised how Robert Del Naja was part of a graffiti movement. He kind of kick-started the movement, not only in Bristol, but even in the UK. He was one of the real original graffiti artists under his old moniker, Delge, of 3D. Banksy said 3D was a big influence on me. Robert Del Naja said, oh, Banksy was a big influence on me. People always assumed that they were friends, but no one suggested they're just talking about themselves. He's just talking about himself to throw people off the chase. The turning point, or the point where I said to myself, I've got him, as if I had like a net, I'm running behind Banksy and I'm like, I caught him, was in Naples. But in August 2004, Banksy left a stencil called Madonna con la Pistola. Robert Del Naja, funny name, Italian name. His dad is from Naples, and he is a crazy Napoli football fan. And the first time that he attended the stadium was almost the exact same time when Banksy left the stencil there. And that's when I said to myself, you fucking done it, son. You know, I was like, it's him. It is him. Robert Del Naja is Banksy.
And in fact, Craig Williams was wrong, Daryl, because there were many places where Massive Attack also had played, where Banksy was making a mural in some other city, in some other part of the world. So that was, that was disproved quite early, I think, in the documentary. I don't think you were that fascinated to know who Banksy was as much as what his art was saying.
Yeah, that's right. You know, this is a film that asks what I think are a number of quite important questions about art. The most important is who owns art? Who's it actually for? Who should own it? Who should have possession of it? Especially with the street artist, you know, because there are a number of, you know, kind of villainous gallery owners who want to get their hands on authentic Banksy's. And so there is a legal question of who owns art, but there's also a sort of moral and emotional question about who should own it. There are questions about the relationship between art and commerce, you know, and the relationship between, you know, the role of an artist like Banksy putting himself forward, at least as a social critic, and I think he is, but he's also at the same time somebody who's deeply implicated in the intense filthy lucre of the art world. So he has it both ways. But to be very honest, I am simply uninterested in the identity of Banksy. You know, why should we? It's a game, and I don't really want to play it.
Yes, and a game he gets a lot of publicity out of. Now, if there's a villain in the piece, I guess it's Robert Barton, who runs the Maddox Gallery in London. He recalls being offered a roll of Banksy prints by the art dealer before Banksy became well known.
I was sat in my photography gallery, and an art dealer who I knew came in, and he had a roll, size of this, of Banksy prints, and they were all rude coppers. He peeled one off, put it down on my desk, and said, "Do you want to buy these?" It was a picture of a copper holding his finger up like this, called rude copper, and I didn't get it. Within 2 weeks, I realised my mistake, and that suddenly these works were taking off. And kids were going in to these pop-up shows that Banksy were doing, buying these prints, going straight back to their digs, getting on their computer, getting onto eBay and flipping them for profit, and create this crazy market that took off at such an exponential speed, it was quite shocking to watch.
Robert Barton there from the Banksy documentary that we're discussing now with Tara Brady and Daryl Jones. Tara, to the art then. The art is quite simple, isn't it? It's very figurative, and it says very simple political, it makes very simple political statements, or political statements in a simple way.
Yeah, it does. No, I mean, it's very kind of classically of its genre, I suppose. And you know, given that he basically codified that genre, that's not all that surprising. I mean, you can really talk about, if you were talking about graffiti in any kind of sense, you'd have to talk about pre-Banksy and post-Banksy. I don't think there's enough of that sort of analysis in the film. I do think you get a little, and I think you get a little bit of the art versus commerce, as Daryl was pointing out. And then you get this other through strand, which is different journalists. You get like the Metro reporter, Martine Berg Olsen, with her suggestion. So it's sort of like three films three films that are running kind of parallel but don't really intersect all that convincingly. I was certainly entertained by it. I didn't learn anything particularly new about Banksy, and I don't think it is probably the best place to start with Banksy. I think Exit to the Gift Shop, his own film from a documentary from a few years ago, would be a much better place to start. It is a decent enough primer for someone who doesn't really know anything at all about Banksy or his art, but it certainly
not a huge explanation of the
Let's
art
just say
I
that.
Thought and stars out of five for Banksy Most Wanted, Tara?
Three.
And for you, Daryl?
Yes, same again, three
out of five. So okay as a primer, as Tara says. Finally, we have My Father and Me from documentary maker Nick Broomfield, who again has gone to his own life story for inspiration, this time in exploring the life and work of his father, Morris Broomfield, the preeminent industrial photographer of post-war Britain. Tara, tell us a little bit about the elder Broomfield, Morris.
Well, his photographs, and they make up happily a huge percentage of the film. It is actually just looking at his photographs are incredibly beautiful. He, as you said, he was one of the Britain's preeminent industrial photographer, which doesn't sound that glamorous, but by golly, the photos are very glamorous. They're very carefully composed. They transform sort of ordinary factories, car factories of the 50s into something like, you know, science fiction. They're almost like something staged by Stanley Kubrick in places. He really found sort of the kind of poetry and the art in post-war industrial Britain, and it won him numerous awards for critics, including Industrial Photographer of the Year. His son Nick had this very ambiguous relationship with his father's work. He didn't really get it. And Nick, as we know, is one of the most recognisable documentary makers in the world. And so this is a very kind of interesting full circle documentary, because Nick Broomfield, as we know, started off as a very kind of politically charged filmmaker. He made these non-scripted films. They were very about reality. And then he becomes this sort of celebrity kind of filmmaker. But his more recent works have been much more contemplative. And I think this may be my favorite film of his, because it combines two strands of his recent works. You know, he's done those big sort of celebrity portraits like Whitney, Can I Be Me? But he's also done very personal films like Marion and Leonard, which combines both the personal memoir aspect and celebrity. And this is a bit like that, because Morris Broomfield is a very glamorous figure, and Nick Broomfield's mother is very glamorous. Like, he makes the point she looks like a movie star, and she does. She looks like one of those Middle European silent screen stars. So they're this very glamorous family, and this is a very kind of wonderful and beautiful looking film from that part alone.
Daryl, you would have to agree that it would make any adult or child trying to retrace their family, their youth, jealous because of the footage he has access to, both the photographs of his father and then all these home movies.
Oh my goodness me, yes. I mean, I just to reiterate Tara's point though about the photographs, these are absolutely beautiful works of art. They really are. And for me, by far the best thing about the film is just gawping at these extraordinary beautiful photographs. But yes, then there's the home movies. There's the footage from his childhood, and he had in the way that a certain kind of English bohemian family or sort of Anglo-Czech, to be very precise, bohemian family that he comes from, you know, so they live in a water mill, which we are told is, you know, utterly impractical because it's freezing in the winter, but it's really good for the shared family hobby and pastime of nudism in the summer months. Morris and co and family, we were told, you know, and we are shown photographs.
Get their
kits off at the slightest provocation. But he also, you know, he buys a gypsy caravan, one of these, you know, kind of classic romantic caravans as a kind of holiday home. And then, you know, then we meet Nick's uncle, who's a wildlife documentary maker who films with David Attenborough, and brings back from his travels a variety of, you know, exotic pets.
I was wondering, what would David Attenborough think?
I don't know.
Brought home the wild animals, yeah.
Yeah, bring back a bear from Indonesia. And when he said my uncle had a bear that we used to play with as a child, I thought he was talking about a teddy bear. But no, it's an actual Indonesian bear that he brought back, that he walked through the streets of London in the parks. Brings back a flying squirrel from his visit to the Himalayas in search of the Yeti. This was very much not like my family growing up in sort of the 1970s. Of Britain, I would have to say that.
So, Daryl, stars out of five for My Father and Me by Nick Broomfield.
Well, you know, there's much to like, and the photographs are wonderful. I can't help but find Broomfield's films a little too self-regarding very often. And this is too, I fear. So 3.5 for me.
And for you, Tara?
I liked it a bit better than that. I found it very moving.
Four and three and a half. That's for My Father and Me. My thanks to Daryl Jones and Tara Brady. My Father and I will be screened on BBC Two at 9:45 this Saturday, March 20th. You can find Banksy Most Wanted through the IFI player, and Preparations to Be Together for an Unknown Period of Time is released through Curzon Home Cinema. You're listening to Thursday Night's Arena. DC there in their 1975 single It's a Long Way to the Top If You Want to Rock and Roll, featuring the original lead vocalist Bon Scott. At that stage in 1975, brothers Angus and Malcolm Young, founders of AC/DC, were just 20 and 22 years old. But as we all know, they would go on to conquer the globe, and the band still play to audiences in tens of thousands today. Joining them on that incredible journey as a crew member in 1974 was a young 16-year-old girl called Tana Douglas, who would also go on to forge a career that involved touring with everyone from The Who to Ozzy Osbourne, The Police and many more. Tana Douglas has documented her life on the road in her memoir, which have just been published. It's called Loud, A Life in Rock and Roll, by the world's first female roadie. And the woman behind the story joins us now. From LA. Tana, you're very welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
We'll come to AC/DC and others in a moment, but you describe yourself back then as a runaway. What and who were you running from?
I was running from what life had offered me to date. You know, I mean, I'd had a very tumultuous childhood, and I had an unstable mother, and it just wasn't getting any better. So by the time, you know, I'd been transferred to live with my father at the age of 11, and he had a grandmother, my grandmother, that just didn't want me there. So there was never, you know, there was never a home environment. So I didn't see any reason to stay. It was just chaotic and causing problems. So I thought I'd best leave.
What role did the tightrope walker, Philly Petit, play in getting you started on your life as a roadie?
Well, my first stop when I ran away from home was to a festival called the Nimbin Festival, which was in Australia. And Philippe Petit, who's a French tightrope walker, the one who walked across the Twin Towers in New York, he had been sponsored to come out by the government, actually. The council paid for him to come out and appear at this festival. And so I bumped into him and his troupe there. And when they mentioned they were going down to Sydney, which is, you know, was the big smoke in those days. And I said, well, you know, I wanted to come along. They were going to do this commando tightrope walk across Sydney Harbour Bridge. And it was like, sounded really exciting. So inadvertently, that's how I became involved in production. That was my first stint at any sort of production. Even though it wasn't music, it was still putting on a performance, and all the work that it took to do that, you know, under the cover of darkness, actually, because no one could know we were doing it. So it was inadvertently my first production, and that's what got me started.
Now, the first band you worked with was a band called Fox, but what made you think that you could be a roadie? Because it's heavy slog work, isn't it? I mean, it requires great strength, not saying the women can't be strong. Looking at it and observing it, you would think, that's a difficult job.
Yeah, but, you know, my life had been pretty difficult. So, you know, it didn't occur to me that there was going to be an easy option for me out there. So, you know, when I found out that, you know, I got invited to a concert, you know, my first electric concert in a club, and the person who I got introduced to stuck me next to the front of house sound console. And, you know, I found myself more fascinated with what was going on there than really what was going on the stage, you know, and I was noticing people passing up guitars and, you know, fixing mic stands, and the two people next to me to my left at the consoles were, you know, working away doing stuff, and it was fascinating to me. It's like, what's going on here? And that was when I first heard the term roadie, you know, so it didn't occur to me that girls didn't do the job.
Now, can you recall when you first met the young brothers, Angus and Malcolm, the founding members of AC/DC?
Yes, it was not long after I'd started doing this for a job, and I'd been transferred down to Melbourne with that band you mentioned, Fox. And I got approached. We'd go in every Monday to pick up our worksheets for the week to the booking agency, Mushroom House. And I got approached by one of the managers there, and he said, you know, you ever think of working for a different band? And, you know, I said, well, I've got one. You know, he said, yeah, but they're not going to last long. You should probably jump ship, you know. And I panicked when I heard they weren't going to last long and I could be out of a job, you know. So he set up for me to go over to this house, and the manager of the band at the time threw me in his car and took me over there. And I walked into this unassuming house in the suburbs of St Kilda in Melbourne, Australia, and there was a bunch of guys just standing in the living room chatting, and the group consisted of Angus, Malcolm, Bon, and George and Harry Vander, George Young and Harry Vander. So it was kind of a little confusing because there was two distinct age groups going on in the room, so I wasn't quite sure what was happening there. But then they explained it to me that, you know, they were looking for a bass player still and a drummer, and but they were ready to start working, and George could play bass, you know, when they did live shows until they found someone and they had a drummer who could stand in. And was I interested? And it was like there was something going on in that room. There was a definite energy, and it was very there was a lot of excitement, and there was so much positive energy and so much conviction, and but also like a kind of an ease to it as well, as though this is just what's going to happen, you know. So it was like, sign me up, whatever it is, I'm in.
And what was the job like then on a day-to-day basis? Is it very different from today? I guess the setups aren't as sophisticated as they are today, you know, with the vast lighting. And then was it rough doing your job, like on the road with guys? Was there any, you know, was that particularly uncomfortable for women, for a woman?
Well, I think it was uncomfortable for everyone. You know, there was no luxuries. You know, there were no amenities turned on whatsoever. You were lucky if you got to eat anything. There were never any showers available, so it's not as though you could wash and have a shower after the show or anything like they do today. And then you'd get in a van or a truck and drive yourself to the next show, you know. So it was a hard slog. And during that time in Australia, you know, you could do two or three shows every night, you know. I mean, some weeks we do 12, 14 shows in a week, and all at different locations. So, I mean, it was a frantic pace. So you really didn't have time to think about it. You just put your head down and did the job, you know.
So Angus was the lead guitarist, and he's very famous for wearing the schoolboy uniform. Did you know why he did that? Was that some kind of, you know, something that liberated him?
Well, they did. They tried a few different costumes early on in the days. You know, he had a Zorro costume at one point. You know, he had a prison costume at another point. And, you know, so they tried different things. But it was the schoolboy one that stuck. And because he was so young and he was so little, you know, when he put on the schoolboy uniform, he just looked like a little kid. So it was, you know, it became an alter ego for him, definitely, because he was quite shy in the beginning. So he'd just sit back and, you know, drink his milk, eat his chocolates and smoke cigarettes. You know, he didn't do any alcohol or drugs or anything like that. You know, so the school uniform was very befitting.
And you also say about Bon Scott, who was the original singer that we heard there in AC/DC. So he had such charisma on stage, and yet backstage you reckon he was racked with self-doubt.
Yeah, I mean, he always had the charisma, whether he was on stage or off stage. But you'd catch him at moments and you'd see that he was just, you know, there were insecurities. You know, it's amazing to me over the years how many of these established, famous performers have such insecurities, you know. And I think it's the pressure from the job, you know. I mean, it's a constant, they're on constant demand, you know. So different people deal with it different ways.
You talk at one stage about, like, you're part of the crew and you're going backstage to do your job. And I think you're on stage, you're sharing the stage with Deep Purple, and some heavy guy comes out and tries to stop you getting on stage. Is that just raw sexism there?
Yeah, I mean, it was a, you know, it was the last masculine domain, sort of, you know, and they were guarding it fiercely at the time. And, you know, this security guy, I mean, it was quite funny, really, because AC, it was a large festival we were doing, outdoor festival, and, you know, the band went one way to the dressing room area. I peeled off and went to the left to go to the stage, and this big, burly security guy's like, whoa, 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 little girl, where do you think you're going? And I'm like, no, no, it's okay, I'm with the band. And he's like, yeah, right, if you're with the band, go find them. No, 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 you know, but he wouldn't listen to me. And he got quite aggressive, actually. He's like, you know, you got to get out of here, get out. And it was, I'd only took one of the men from the stage who saw what was happening, luckily, and he yelled down, no, 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 she's a roadie, she's one of us. And the guy grudgingly let me up, but it didn't matter what I said, it didn't matter. You know, I could have sworn up and down blue, you know, until I was blue in the face. It wasn't having any effect whatsoever.
You were obviously 100% involved in the stage and getting the stage ready for the bands, but did you have other roles then? Let's say when I suppose fans, male or female, were trying to get at band members, did you have any role to play in that interface?
Yeah, I would try to stay away from that as much as humanly possible, being a female, because it was always, well, why is she allowed there if we're not allowed there, you know? So I would try to stay away, but it didn't work, you know, quite often I'd be the brunt of some disgruntled fan taking a swing at me or something. It was a bit rough. It got a little rough out there for a while, you know, and that's when I was doing stage, you know, looking after the guitars and the backline equipment and Bon. And so when I moved to doing front of house sound, it wasn't quite so bad because I had that separation from the stage.
And then you moved on from AC/DC. Was that because they may have had sojourns where they weren't touring and therefore you had to find other bands to tour with?
Well, it was a little bit of that, but also I'd gone from doing backline to front of house sound. And, you know, their first album had just come out and it was, you know, flying up the charts. So the venues were getting bigger and bigger. So it was, you know, we were requiring larger and larger sound systems. And no one had trained me. No one had taught me how to do it. They just sort of thrown me at it and said, off you go. You know what the band wants, so we want you to do it. And it's like, wait, what? I don't think that's how it works, you know. So, you know, I was finding myself, you know, getting into more and more of these different equipments and effects and stuff and still no one to teach me. So I decided I had to make a decision that if I was going to continue to do this, I needed to stop, take a step back and find someone to teach me how to do it properly, you know, because otherwise, you know, there's a lot of equipment, there's a lot of expensive equipment, you know, there's a lot of electricity and stuff. It can get dangerous if you don't know what you're doing, you know.
Now you
I took that chance, yeah.
And now you toured with many, many rock bands, but then you started getting into working with punk bands, Iggy Pop in particular. And you talk about a concert and the band are all ready to get on stage and know Iggy.
Oh, God. He was such a brat. Yeah. It was at London, actually, at the Music Machine, and we just finished a short European tour, and these were the last four shows of the tour, and it was all sold out, so it should have been a wonderful thing, you know. But no. Iggy decides to lock himself in the dressing room, and I'm at the front of house position. The house lights go out, so that's when the band's meant to work on stage and start performing. But I get a message through the intercom, I have to come backstage, and Iggy's locked himself in his dressing room. It's like, what? No. So I have to fight my way through the crowd, battle my way up the stairs, down the hallway. There's people everywhere. And it's like, what's going on? It's like, he won't come out until he sees you. And it's like, what? And there'd been this ongoing thing between him and David Bowie all tour. You know, Iggy had wanted David to be there and David hadn't turned up. They'd had a little spat and they weren't talking. So anyway, I bang on the door and it's like, James Osterberg, you need to get out here now. And he opens the door, sees it's me, giggles, grabs me and pulls me in and shuts the door and locks it. And it's like, what are you doing? You know, stop that. And so he's, you know, he's talking away and he's doing various illicit substances. And all of a sudden he says to me, oh, you know, there's somebody here who I want you to meet. And I'm really angry at this point because it's ridiculous. I mean, we're going to have a riot downstairs. So I'm like, I'm not happy with whoever this other person is and I'm paying them zero attention. And Iggy grabs him and drags him over, you know. And basically he goes, oh, you know, hi, you know, I want you to meet this. And this guy is, and it's like David Bowie, you know, and I'm like, oh, you know. So, I mean, you'll have to read the book to find out the bits that I'm missing out on this radio show.
Yes, maybe the drugs and rock and sex and drugs bit.
But you did tour.
Well, I'll just ask you one more. You went on tour, you left the business for a while and you had a child, you came back. And I suppose to ease yourself back, you started working with Ozzy Osbourne. What was that experience like?
Yeah, so much for easing yourself back into it. What was I thinking? Yeah, that was the first Blizzard of Oz tour. So it was chaos. It was chaos. I mean, the crew was amazing. It was an amazing crew on that. And that was the only reason why I could justify staying on it. It was just, otherwise it was horrible. It was a big mess. It was when he and Sharon first started together and it was horrible.
And
there was no money.
Would she have been managing him at that stage?
She just started managing him. She'd had the falling out with her dad, Don Arden. So, you know, there was a lot of friction going on. There was a lot of turmoil. We weren't getting paid. You know, we weren't getting our per diems. They wouldn't even give us an itinerary, so we knew where we were going. I think they thought if they gave us an itinerary, we'd all run away.
Yes.
We'd see how many shows we had to do and go, no, we're leaving.
And just finally, Tana, at the final section of your book, and we talked about AC/DC there, and there have been a very sad deaths in that band. You have a section entitled In Memoriam, where you talk about an awful lot of the people you lost in that business. A precarious business, isn't it?
It is. It is. It's a hard job. You know, it's a hard job, but it gets in your blood and you love it. And, you know, if it doesn't kill you, it's a hell of a way to make a living, you know. But the in memoriam thing is it's quite a long list. And, you know, there's severe problems that are had by people who do this profession. You know, there's a lot of mental health problems from the stress. There's a lot of physical problems. And, you know, there was very little health and safety codes back in the early days. So a lot of people got hurt, maimed, and some even died, you know. But, so it's tough, you know, it's tough.
Yes, well, it's a very fitting tribute to them at the end of the book. And the book is Loud.
Thank you
very much, Tana. Loud is the book, A Life in Rock and Roll, by the world's first female roadie. It's out now, published by HarperCollins. And thanks to Tana Douglas for joining us. Now, if you're getting a little complacent or comfy in your TV watching, well, it's time to buck up, as there's lots of bent coppers out there, fella. Yes, Ted Hastings, Kate and Steve of AC12 are back on our screens on Sunday evening in what is undoubtedly one of the TV events of the year, Line of Duty Season 6. Jed Mercurio's police drama starts our favourite anti-corruption cops, Adrian Dunbar as Superintendent Ted Hastings, Vicky McClure as DI Kate Fleming, and Martin Copston as DS Steve Arnott. Series 6 takes up the story 18 months on from the last quandary the series left us in, namely, is Ted himself a bent copper? Now we have a new suspect bent cop in the frame, played by Trainspotter and Gigi Hadid, actor Kelly MacDonald, the writer Nico Flaherty caught the Line of Duty bug last summer and was left in such a state of paranoia that she subsequently wrote an essay about it for the Stinging Fly magazine. I'm delighted to say Nicole joins me now. Nicole, we have 7 new episodes to look forward to in the new series. Adrian Dunbar has just about survived falling under suspicion himself in Series 5. Remind us where we are with the anti-corruption unit, AC12.
So we have 7 episodes, which is one more than usual, thank God. But in the last episode, it was revealed that there were, it's kind of hard to explain, but there are 4 potential bent coppers in the unit when we thought there was only 1, and 3 have been revealed. So we're trying to find out who 1 is.
Although the 5 series ends, they have yet to identify the most corrupt cop of them all, the mysterious H.
Yeah.
Questions might be asked how good they are at sleuthing as soon as they can't find him. Let's hear from DS Steve Arnott, Martin Copson, who makes a discovery right at the end of the last series.
Sir.
Sir, we've been re-examining Dot's dying declaration. Now, the frame it was frozen on during your interview made me spot something we've all missed. Look at Dot's left hand.
Right, so his fingers have tapped, so?
Dot was trying to tell us something before he lost consciousness. Now, he couldn't speak due to the gunshot wound to his chest, but he could move his hand.
Tap, 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 tap. Tap, 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 tap. Morse code. Dot, 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 dot.
The letter H in Morse code is four dots. H is not an initial. It's a clue. Four dots, four caddies, four police staff in league with organised crime.
Dot, Hilton, jail, plus one more.
And they're still out there.
So, Nicole, if you can explain that. So, poor old Dot, who was Ben Copper, is dying.
Yes, and he starts that in season three. Yeah.
Yes, and he starts move. They find the video of where he is lying, dying, and they see now that he's moving his finger. And what is his finger saying in Morse code?
Initially, they thought it was he was saying H, but now they think it's Morse code for four. So the H was kind of a red herring. They thought it was Hastings because of the H, but could be anyone really, is the whole point, I think.
Yes, what is it though? You know, it is this level of nonsense and detail that fascinates us all and have us all, you know, chatting about line of duty around the water cooler. What is it that you think is so fascinating about the series?
Well, I only started watching it in the summer. I had never watched any of it before. And I'd never really watched any kind of like police drama before. And I wasn't, you know, sure I was going to enjoy this, but I found it extremely addictive, which was for two reasons, I think, because the first one is the level of detail in every single kind of interaction, which I imagine is because of the extent of the research the writers do. And then the second is the interrogation scenes, which I really enjoy.
You say you gave up a long time ago feeling represented or that you could see yourself in a TV drama. And then Ted Hastings comes along. This is the Adrian Dunbar character, the top man, the daddy figure to the two other characters played, Vicky McClure's Kate Fleming and Martin Copson's Steve Arnott. What is it that makes him so real or relatable, as they say?
I suppose I think because I'm in my early 30s and there's lots of, you know, TV shows written about like women like me or with women like me in mind. And I just never kind of relate to any of them. But I did relate to him just simply, you know, kind of at his like level of frustration and, you know, and it's also kind of desire to do good and things, which I think is kind of relatable. And yeah, there's something just quite Irish.
And he has those wonderful phrases. We've cut together a little series of Ted Hastings sayings here. Obviously, Mother of God and Suckin' Diesel is going to feature heavily.
Superintendent Hastings, like the battle.
Bent coppers.
I've seen enough bent coppers.
You know, if I see a bent copper, I'll go after him.
Bent coppers. He's your bent copper for the 21st century.
Bent coppers.
And I'm doing mine. And it's called Nick and Bent Coppers. Mother of God. Mother of God. Mother of God, they've both been falsified.
Mother of God.
My own team. I am Cam. I'm totally bloody Cam.
Me.
Oh, Jesus, Mary and Joseph.
You could.
No, we're sucking diesel. Go on.
You didn't float up the lagoon on a bubble.
No, we're sucking diesel.
It's beginning to feel a wee bit like the ginger stepchild.
I didn't float up the lagoon in a bubble.
That was very satisfying.
Now, poor Ted is having a tough time. Ted is the head of AC12, but he is having marital problems and he's made bad investments and he's now living in a hotel. Now, that may sound glamorous to some, but poor Ted's hotel is far from glamorous.
You kind of, it's interesting because it's across, there's been five seasons now and you're kind of just getting like little tidbits about their lives. It doesn't really focus on their personal lives a whole lot. So you've just kind of, this has been kind of drip fed to you along the way. I don't think you really see the difficulties in Ted's marriage until like the second season and find out about his bad investments and things. So you're kind of just getting to know them as you go along. But yeah, I'm quite invested in Ted, and I hope he can turn things around in season six.
Yes, and obviously he's in financial trouble, so he never really, even if they bring down the biggest organized crime gang within the force, he'll never throw a big lavish party. They'll be there, drinking a beer in the sad local bar.
I don't think he'd want to throw a lavish party, even if he could afford one. I don't think he's the type.
Now, we'll get on to the other two in the family. As Steve Arnott then was a new recruit in the first series of Line of Duty. How has he developed as a character over the series, do you think?
You kind of don't see a whole lot about his personal life, and then what they all three characters have in common, they've all quite like had consequences to, being part of this like anti-corruption unit. It's taken over their personal lives. They've suffered marital difficulties because of, they're always away from home and whatnot. So you do see that he was in a relationship, and then I think their problems arose in their relationship. And where he is in the new season is that he has back problems. So we saw him, I think, get thrown out a window and were thrown down a flight of stairs in season four.
That's right. He was in a wheelchair for a whole season. Yeah. Yes, and he's quite a man for the ladies.
Yeah, he does well. Surprisingly, I think.
Yes, and he doesn't seem to have any moral code when it comes to, he does a fine line in dating witnesses.
Yes, and I think that's one of the fascinating things I kind of find about the show, because in a lot of cop dramas, they try and make the main cops, heroes, whereas this show, they have no interest in doing that. They all have their own kind of, personal difficulties and things they've done wrong, and I find that quite interesting. So yeah, he's dated witnesses, and that's been brought up in the interrogation room and stuff, and it's been quite explosive.
Yes, and there's a great collection all over the series, hasn't there been, of the Ben Coppers? Have you any particular favourite?
Yes, I do. I think my favourite season was season two. Katie Halls played Lindsay Denton. I think she was the best, but they've all been great. Like Stephen Graham was in season five.
And all these Ben Coppers have like a very interesting story. Like Corbett is so undercover in a criminal gang that sometimes you just go so far, you can't be brought back from the brink or from getting involved.
I think it really kind of delves into these people, the antagonists' kind of lives. You really get to see, the people they're facing off against. Once again, it's like it's quite like 50-50, you're not siding with anyone in particular. It's like the show, I think, does that, it shows the reasons for why they do these things. Lindsay Denton, for example, her mother, she needed to pay for her mother's nursing home and things. It's never totally black and white, which I quite like.
And so this sixth series now, are you fearful that it might come out that Ted is in fact H?
I am, because I think the show only really works when he is just, kind of untouchable. Like he has to be like morally right. So I feel that, they have to bring him back. I just can't believe that he will be H.
All right. Well,
but maybe one of the other two.
This is true. This is true.
Yeah.
Mike, Nicole Flattery, thank you so much. Line of Duty begins this Sunday on BBC One at 9 p.m. And Nicole's essay, Essential Viewing, is on stingingfly.org. So I'm afraid, as our friends in Line of Duty would say, urgent exit is required now from Arena as our time is up. On sound this evening was Pather Carney. Research was by Paula Shields and Liam Murphy. The broadcast coordinator was Janice Furphy. And tonight's programme was produced by Olam McGowan.